You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jeff Smith was sentenced to a year in federal prison in 2009 after he pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice charges. The charges stem from what at the time had seemed like a minor violation of campaign law during his unsuccessful bid for one of Missouri's congressional seats in 2004. After that loss, Jeff Smith went on to be elected to the Missouri State Senate, where he represented St. Louis until he resigned after he was indicted. He describes his experiences in prison and looks at ways our prison system can be improved in a book called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. It's published by St. Martin's Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Jeff Smith to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
The title of your book is obviously a play on Frank Capra's 1939 movie with Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But doesn't it also refer back to a documentary movie that was directed by Frank Popper about you in 2006 called Can Mr. Smith Get to Washington Anymore?
It does. That movie basically asked, can a political nobody, 29 years old, I was an adjunct college professor, going against the scion of Missouri's top political dynasty, the Carnahan family, can a regular Joe get to Congress anymore was really the question.
And it was that congressional race that got you in trouble.
It was.
Didn't you have a certain advantage there in that you were replacing Dick Gephardt, who's a liberal, and Russ Carnahan is a conservative?
He was not a conservative.
Oh.
He was a Democrat as well. Mm-hmm. So this was a 10-person primary in which, you know, he had the bulk of the money, all the name ID, the endorsements, and was, you know, widely seen to be the front runner. So there were five or six elected officials, and I was a nobody.
Does the documentary include any information about the crime for which you were convicted?
It does not.
It is a little complicated.
It only happened. It literally was like 5 minutes of the entire campaign, but it was a fateful 5 minutes.
And it's kind of complicated, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but can you explain this whole business about being involved in this thing that, and the attempted cover-up of two federal election law violations?
Sure. So about a month from Election Day in my primary, two of my aides came to me and said that a man had approached them wanting to put out a postcard about my opponent's poor attendance record in the state house. Instead of telling them, no, I don't think we're supposed to have any dealings with like a third party, I said, look, this sounds fishy, but I don't want to know the details. Just don't tell me anything. So they didn't. And a postcard came out about a week from Election Day. It was a little tiny amateurish thing, but that didn't really have an impact. I lost by a little more than 1%, but my opponent filed a complaint with the Federal Election Commission. I responded to the complaint by signing an affidavit which denied knowledge of anything relating to the postcard, even though I knew my aides had met with the guy who I presumed put it out. 5 years after that, when I was in the state Senate, my best friend wore a wire for 2 months and got me to admit knowing about that meeting my aides had, and that led to federal prison.
He was sentenced to a year and a day. Have other politicians gone to prison for similar offenses?
No. Other politicians have gone to prison for signing false affidavits, I presume. But
right
the
now,
underlying
the Texas Attorney General is being at least pursued in this regard.
For underlying securities violations from which he profited, I think, hundreds of thousands of dollars. For the underlying offense, no, I'm the only politician who's ever gone to prison for coordination, as you will.
And when you arrived in prison, you told your fellow inmates that your best friend, Steve Brown, had worn a wire to put you away. Didn't several of them suggest that you have him killed?
They did.
On the other hand, another prisoner told you to forget about Steve Brown while you were locked up, and you've said that that was the best advice you ever were given.
It was. I met a guy who was my supervisor, my prison supervisor at the warehouse. I worked unloading food trucks every day, was my full-time job. And the supervisor there was a pretty wise man about my age, and he'd been the leading drug dealer, I think, in Owensboro, Kentucky. He told me that his first 4 or 5 years in prison, he couldn't even sleep. He said he almost killed himself because he was so obsessed with getting back at his brother-in-law, who had ratted him out. And he said then one day he made a conscious decision. He was going to forget about that, forgive the guy. And then he said he could finally breathe again. And every day since then, he said, had been better than the day before. I did the same thing with similar results.
Have you bumped into Steve Brown since?
I have not. That's not true. He came to a speech that I gave in St. Louis about a year or two ago.
Now, you're not a big guy.
No.
And you, as you point out here, you had a much higher education level, more financial resources than almost anyone you met in prison. That includes the guards and the administrators. How did you wind up unloading food trucks with other people who I assumed were much bigger than you, much more capable of carrying heavy bags of rice?
So I came into prison at like 117 pounds. And I got in a little hot water my first week. The captain of the prison, who's like the number two, kind of like the dean of discipline if prison were private school, he intercepted correspondence that basically suggested that I might be entering into a contract while I was in prison to write a book. And I told him that I wouldn't be profiting at all. I had given an attorney power of attorney to sign, so it wasn't like I was actually running business out of the prison. I understood that it was prohibited to like run a tattoo parlor or, you know, some other type of business. And he told me that in his parlance, he said, is that your interpretation, Smith? He said, because I got news for you. This ain't no Senate here, and this ain't no Supreme Court. This is the BOP, and if I think you's conducting a business, then you's probably conducting a business. And then the next day, I got word that I was assigned to the warehouse where I worked with six other guys. They were like 230, 250, 260, like 280, 305, and 315, and 350. And we moved about 35 to 40,000 pounds of food in and out of the warehouse and in and out of freezers every day, which fed about 2,500 prisoners.
Now, bodybuilding is a big thing in most prisons. Was this kind of a bodybuilding experience for you?
Yeah, I put on 30 pounds of muscle while I was locked up. So, and in fact, about 6 months ago, my wife suggested that I just like do something small, like, you know, forge a check or something so that I could go back away for a brief period and get my muscle back. Yeah.
Didn't working in the warehouse have some perks because the warehouse crew was able to steal food and could later barter that with other prisoners or eat it themselves?
The warehouse was the best thing that ever happened to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, you're right. We were able to steal food, and then I used that food back on the yard to give it out to a few other people to build strategic alliances and protect myself from a couple threatening things that had happened. The second way that, because everybody is looking to get protein, right? And so if you can have some type of protein source or some type of healthy food that's better than what people normally get, it's very, very valuable in the compound.
But you had determined not to break prison rules by stealing and then change your mind because you realized it was a survival strategy.
Well, you're right. I promised my wife, well, she wasn't my wife then, but she's my wife now, and I promised her that I would not break any rules. I promised my parents, I promised myself, but then a week in, another inmate came to me and said that other prisoners were going to plant raw meat in my freezer jacket. Stealing raw meat carries a huge penalty because it could have E. coli and therefore poison the entire prison. Then the penalty for it is as severe as like inciting a riot. And so I didn't want that to happen. And the reason that they were going to plant that on me is because I was the only one who wasn't stealing. And so they figured I must be getting ready to rat them all out. So I kind of felt like I had to start stealing to prevent that outcome.
My guest is Jeff Smith. His book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. You logically would have been teaching, and you did start tutoring inmates for the GED exams. You discovered that many of them were functionally illiterate.
That's right. I applied to teach several different courses while I was there. All of that was turned down by the prison.
Even though you had taught on a college level before you went to prison.
Yeah, I've taught, off and on while I was in the Senate for about 15 years. But No, I wasn't allowed to do that. But I did tutor informally every night pretty much while I was there. Different, either people who were taking the GID or the GED or just helped other people read books who were struggling to do so.
How many of the prisoners had finished high school?
It's tough to say. I would say maybe half.
The Manchester prison that you were sent to is located in Clay County, Kentucky, where the New York Times, a place where the New York Times is called the nation's most miserable county. It's just over 500 miles from your home. Any idea why you were sent so far away? Weren't there any federal maximum or minimum security prisons closer to St. Louis?
There were. I did not have a very good rapport with the prosecutor, to put it mildly. He was interested in going beyond me and nabbing a higher level elected official than me, and hoped, I think, for my cooperation in doing so. The people that he was interested in, I didn't want to entrap them, and I thought they were decent people. And so since then, after that, he pressed for a very harsh sentence, and even I requested to go to prison close by to facilitate visits from loved ones. I was sent to the very furthest possible place.
And you're right that you were terrified that your parents could be killed in an accident on their 14-hour drive to visit you, and you wouldn't be allowed to attend their funerals. The imagination runs wild.
Yeah, the imagination. And that was the main reason that I wanted to be close by, was so they could come see me. And thankfully, they survived. They're 76 and 71 now, so they've done well, but it was a very, very difficult year for them.
Many Americans assume that white-collar criminals end up in the so-called country club-type prisons with relatively nice amenities and nonviolent fellow inmates. That didn't happen here. Are there places like that anymore in America?
I don't think there are. I remember seeing some exposés about places with, like, tennis courts and putting greens back in the 80s, but I went to prison overwhelmingly with drug dealers.
Not white-collar criminals.
No, there were probably five or so other white-collar criminals that I met during my time there. But it was about probably 60% cocaine dealers, and the rest either oxy or meth. Meth is pretty big in Kentucky. So that was most of the white people in prison were there for meth.
So this is a so-called minimum security prison, although there was a medium security prison on the same grounds that prisoners who misbehaved could be transferred to. And weren't you frequently threatened with the possibility of that or being sent to solitary confinement?
Yeah, that was a frequent threat that COs made if they found contraband in your cell, or if they just wanted to prevent you from mouthing them for any reason. They would say, hey, do you want to go to the SHU? The special housing unit. And there were people who I saw come out of the SHU, really changed men who just seemed to be suffering from PTSD after being there.
And you never were sent to solitary?
No, thankfully.
Although, didn't you see two prisoners ask to be transferred to the SHU?
I did. There was.
Why would anybody do that?
For their own protection. There was one guy who had burned crosses, and he stupidly let people know. He told me that he had burned crosses when he was cutting my hair. He was like the white barber. There was a black barber and a white barber on the compound, and he cut my hair. And he told me, not knowing, of course, that I was a black studies major in college who represented a majority black Senate district and, you know, was very interested in racial equality, let me know that he had burned crosses. That suggested that he wasn't being very discreet about it. I wasn't the one who spread that, but once it did spread, it became clear that he was in real trouble, and he volunteered to go into solitary to protect himself, I think.
My guest is Jeff Smith, the former Missouri state senator who represented the city of St. Louis from 2007 until 2009. Before he went into prison. Currently, he is an assistant professor at the New School's Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy. And he's written a book called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jeff Smith. His book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis, published by St. Martin's Press. You've written about race and said that that was the biggest factor shaping life in Manchester. About one half the prisoners were black, one third were white, and the rest were Latino or Asian. Did prisoners of the same race tend to stick together and avoid interactions with inmates of other races?
Yes. And there were sort of informal prohibitions on doing certain things with prisoners of another race.
Now, you, outside of prison, you mentioned that you had represented an African-American majority district. Was anybody aware of that? Did that affect the way you interacted with people?
I don't know if anyone was aware of that or not. I caused some issues early on in my tenure when I had dinner with a group of black people and then received like a stern talking to by a white kind of leader in the prison. And then I frequently played basketball. I was like one of the only white guys in the prison basketball league. There was one other guy. And that turned some heads when I did that, because white inmates are expected to play like softball or do certain things and not play basketball. So,
but you were working with a lot of mostly black prisoners when you were moving all of the food. Didn't you eat together?
It's kind of hard to explain, but we were the only people, the seven of us who worked in the warehouse, we were like the only prisoners on the compound that actually had to be somewhere in a certain time to please like vendors, right? Because the milk truck, the bread truck, the vegetable and fruit truck, they were coming. So we only had like 10 or 15 minutes to eat. So we would come back for lunch back to the compound at like 10 in the morning, and we had to be, you know, eat very quickly and go out. So we got to butt ahead of everyone else in the line. And so because we were treated specially because of that job, we ate together at one table and went back. But for dinner, you know, you weren't supposed to do that. So I didn't eat with them for dinner, and I went back and ate with white people.
You've said that white prisoners generally have a more difficult time than black prisoners handling prison's daily humiliations because they're not as accustomed to being humiliated in their everyday lives.
Yeah, I'm not sure I put it exactly like that, but I think there are definitely I definitely saw instances of white people who were just totally unaccustomed to being spoken to by guards in a certain way and really kind of chafed at that. And I mean, I saw some black inmates chafe at it too, but there's some scholarship on different sides of that.
You were assigned to share a cell with a black prisoner named Red. Was that unusual?
It was very unusual. I think we were the only, there may have been one other, but I think we were the only interracial pairing in the compound.
And for a while you got along well, but then that changed.
Yeah, that changed one night when he believed that a hair of mine had fallen from the top bunk to the bottom bunk.
A hair?
A hair had fallen onto his pillow. And he told me that he found a cracker hair on his bunk and I needed to get rid of it. And then a sort of confrontation ensued. And I ended up transferring to another cell.
And do you really think that was the reason?
It escalated very quickly from there. And he had a problem with my hygiene. Hygiene is very important in prison. People can't control very much, and so they want to control their cleanliness. And he wanted me to shower three times a day, and I didn't want to shower three times a day. He'd been in and out of prison for 25 years, and he believed it was his right to kind of own the cell. And he wanted me to shower immediately when I came home from working in the warehouse in the afternoon every day. Since I knew I was going to play in a basketball game that night, I figured I would shower at the end of the day. And that was really the root of the conflict between us. Although the cracker hair, my hair that fell onto his pillow was the immediate spark.
You devote an entire chapter of your book to rape. Haven't you found that it's a subject almost everyone you meet after you're released is kind of curious about, whether they admit it or not?
Yes, that's exactly what I found. I write in the book about a party that I went to in Brooklyn right when I first moved to New York, where everyone was sort of ignoring me There were, you know, a lot of journalists and kind of new media type people and, you know, creative types. And they were kind of ignoring me until the host told them that I'd been to prison. And then they all, it was late in the night and they were pretty liquored up. And then they were sort of trying to dance around it, but they really wanted to know if I'd been, you know, raped.
How worried were you about the possibility of being raped before you started your sentence?
I didn't think too much about it. Once I got there, it's a frequent topic of conversation in the prison.
Especially when you find yourself attracting a big guy named Mr. C.
Big C. Yeah, there was one guy who was, he pursued me pretty vigorously for a few months. He came to every softball, basketball, football game, every game that I played in. He came, sat in the front row, cheered loudly for me, and approached me, you know, frequently.
And a man at the warehouse protected you.
That's right.
He warned him away?
He did. He was a big fellow, weighed about 315 pounds, and Big C was big and strong, but this guy who protected me was much more feared on the compound. And at a critical juncture when Big C kind of was making his move, my friend at the warehouse.
KY. Is it KY?
It was actually Vill.
Vill?
Short for Louisville.
What do you think would have happened if Vill hadn't stood up for you that day?
I don't know. It's tough to say. I know that I owe a lot of my safety in prison to the guys that I worked with at the warehouse who stood up for me at a bunch of really critical junctures, and I'll never forget that.
My guest is Jeff Smith. His book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis, published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've included a list of advice for newly incarcerated prisoners, including don't eat any candy offered to you or left in your cell. Is it poisoned?
No. During orientation, we were shown a video, and in the video, a middle-aged man said that he had inadvertently eaten a Snickers bar that was left on his pillow when he entered prison, not realizing that that was a sign to a sexual predator that he was willing. And so the sort of joke after everyone sees the orientation video is don't eat the Snickers. And, you know, and yeah.
Now, you said earlier that you were punished because they knew that you were going to write a book. But you continued to work on your notes while you were there. You say you stayed up later at night than everybody else.
I wrote on napkins. I mean, I didn't. I tried to be careful, and I hid the – once I transferred the writing on the napkins to pieces of paper, I stored them in another person's cell in exchange for bringing onions and green peppers to him, so that if they tossed my cell, which they did several times, that they wouldn't find the book and confiscate my notes.
And how important were those notes for writing the book?
They were the basis of the book.
Among the interesting things you reveal here is that there's a high incidence of dyslexia among U.S. prisoners. Weren't people in prison found to be dyslexic at more than five times the rate of the general population? This sounds like business entrepreneurs and artists.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the connection that I make. That's why I describe it in the book, because entrepreneurs have similarly high rates of dyslexia. And the point I'm trying to make is that the guys that I met in prison had this incredible, untapped, like, entrepreneurial spirit, right? You don't realize, everyone talks about prison and they say, oh, you get three hots and a cot, you're taken care of. But you're not exactly taken care of. Most people in prison are broke. And you have to pay money to buy toothpaste or shampoo, or just the basics of personal hygiene. And that stuff is marked up at the commissary 30 to 50%. So it's pretty expensive. And unless you've got a sugar daddy or somebody putting money on your books, you got to hustle to survive. And so prisoners are creating all these sort of underground businesses to try to make stamps, you know, which can be converted into money. And what I found is that when I went back and did research about this stuff after when I was writing the book, is that the rates of dyslexia are very similar in prison to those for successful entrepreneurs. And it made perfect sense, because the guys that I met in prison could be very successful entrepreneurs running legal businesses on the outside.
So I would assume that this would help them if they decided to start a business, because it's so difficult for ex-cons to get normal jobs. But we don't see too many of them starting businesses.
Well, I think that slowly changed.
Unless that explains Monsanto and DuPont and a few other corporations.
Well, no, I think that's slowly changing, though, Leonard, because there's an incredible nonprofit that, in full disclosure, I'm on the advisory board of, called the Prison Entrepreneurship Program, based in Texas. And they work with a few hundred prisoners every year. They go into the Cleveland State Prison and then another prison in Texas, and they do a 8-month-long MBA-level curriculum certified by Baylor University. And they have visiting corporate executives from all over the world come in and advise these guys on how to craft a full-length business plan. So taking their ideas for like an automotive repair or personal fitness business or home health care and making it a reality. I went down and spoke at their commencement a couple years ago. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I will tell you, the recidivism rate of guys who've gone through that program, it was just over the last 11 years, is just 6.5%. 1/10 the recidivism rate of offenders nationally.
2/3 of all prisoners wind up back in prison.
That's right.
Is that nationally or is that in places like Missouri?
That's nationally. There are some states where you have lower rates.
What about you? Was it challenging to find work after you were released?
It was challenging.
So you could go into teaching because they don't care whether an ex-con is teaching at the new school?
No, I think a lot of places, you know, cared. And I think you know, I struggled. I applied to a lot of different academic positions. And, you know, I had so many advantages that none of the other guys I was locked up with had. I had a PhD from a great university. I'm white. I had a very minor crime that was nonviolent. And I had community support. I had 300 people write letters to the judge requesting clemency on my behalf. Most of these guys that I did time with, they have 10, 15 years in prison. People don't ride that long with them, so they don't have much community support when they get out. They don't have a very good education. They have none of the advantages. They don't have savings. They have none of the advantages I had, and I struggled to get a job. Think of how hard it must be for most people.
You note that people aren't well equipped emotionally to prosper after they've been released from prison because surviving prison requires them to shut down emotionally.
That's right. In prison,
they can't show their emotions or express their or even have emotions.
In prison, you learn not to show emotion. Number one, you don't want to show any fear or weakness because there's predators and they will take advantage of that. You don't want to ever get too high or too low. You might get word that your girlfriend is coming to visit you and then she doesn't show up and there's nothing you can do, you know. And you might get word that this happened to me, that my girlfriend was visiting. And then she came, but she was wearing the wrong color of pants. And so they made her leave. And there were no stores in the nearby town. It's a very rural area.
What was the wrong color?
She was wearing khaki. She thought that was okay because we wore greens. And so you couldn't be confused with an inmate or anything. But they told her she couldn't wear that. She had to leave, come back. She basically drove 16 hours to visit me for about a half hour that day. So you never get too high or too low because they can take anything away from you in a heartbeat.
And then there's the whole matter of education. We're told that prisons have these college-level programs. That wasn't the case at Manchester.
No, we didn't have any college-level programming. We had there was one GED course, and then there was a hydroponics course offered for about 2.5 weeks.
How to grow tomatoes hydroponically? Why did they think that was a good course for people in prison?
I have no earthly idea. What I do know is that if we were smart in this country, what we would do is figure out jobs where there is a big need and jobs that aren't going to be outsourced or offshored, like, you know, heating, you know, HVAC jobs or electrical wiring or plumbing or home health care, and train people, you know, provide that type of vocational training so that people are equipped with the skills they need to succeed when they get out.
Is part of the problem that prison officials don't have any incentive to cut the recidivism rates because their jobs depend on having a heavy stream of people incarcerated?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Are there certain words that I can't say on this show?
Okay. There are. I can show you the list here, and I'm sure you know them.
Okay, well, then I won't describe this in that detail, but there was one CO that, even though he used more profane language, would tell almost every inmate on their way out, "You'll be back. We'll see you in 6 months." You know, just embodying the attitude that the system seemed to have towards us, that, you know what? And he would actually say, "Guys like you are how I know I'll always have a job."
You've included a number of suggestions here to make the criminal justice system more effective, and prominent among them is allowing nonviolent offenders to serve their sentences at home under electronic monitoring. How much money could be saved by using electronic monitoring rather than confining inmates?
About 85% of what we now spend could be saved that way.
And we're talking about $16 billion a year might be saved?
Correct. Yeah. So for each individual, you would save, it would cost about 15% to electronically monitor them, what it costs to incarcerate them. We know in New York City, I think Rikers Island is about $165,000, the New York Times has estimated, per inmate. Imagine how much we could save, as you said, $16 billion as a country. And that's just, you know, with a subset of the population that is highly unlikely to be a threat.
Is it being used anywhere or seriously considered as an option?
It's being used in some places. It's being used more pre-trial, you know, during kind of the bail process. And I think you've seen Speaker Melissa Mark-Viverito suggest a lot of reforms along those lines.
Well, most of the reforms we're hearing about today are whether drug sentences should be as harsh as they are, and also about cutting down on solitary confinement. Are those the biggest problems?
Those are big problems. We got to get rid of mandatory minimums. It doesn't make sense to hamstring a judge and tell him you got to put this guy away for 15 years because he had a gun in his house and he had this much crack.
Or he had two other offenses.
Or he had two other offenses.
Might have been minor.
Exactly. The three strikes is the second thing that we have to change in terms of sentencing reform. There's a lot of attention being paid to sentencing reform, and I'm glad there's fantastic people like Michelle Alexander and many others out there talking about it. And it's great to see Cory Booker and Rand Paul team up for legislation. What I think we need to do and what my book talks about more is worrying about what's happening inside prison and how a lot of the things we do are actually criminogenic. Instead of helping rehabilitate people, we're probably teaching them to be better criminals and dehumanizing them in many ways so that they don't leave prison with aspirations of being successful.
Jeff Smith's book is called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, thank you so much for having me.